Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. 2 years ago, the Wyoming legislature asked the Wyoming Department of Health to look into the high costs of Medicaid services in the state. The legislature wanted them to find ways to reduce those costs and see if there were also ways to reform Wyoming's developmental disability waiver program, which costs the state $151 million a year. The most popular waiver provides funding for home and community-based services that can keep a child with disabilities from being institutionalized. The department is looking into the possibility of reducing funding for some people and using that savings to reduce a waiting list for others who also need services. It's generated quite a firestorm, as Wyoming Public Radio's Bob Beck reports.
To be clear, legislators told the Department of Health to cut and not expect any new money to reduce the waiting list for developmental disability waivers. Lawmakers like Senator Charles Scott, who chairs the Senate Health and Labor Committee, said that the system allowed people to get funding for more services than they actually wanted or needed.
The existing program provides all the services that the most severely impaired people need. And by tailoring it more carefully to what they really need, we hope to be able to take care of a whole bunch of people that need the service but are on the waiting list right now because we don't have enough money to cover them all.
Wyoming Department of Health Director Tom Forslund says nearly 600 people are on the waiting list, and some have been there for as long as 7 years. To get them off the list, they will need to find nearly $24 million in savings. To try and find the money, Forslund says they've come up with a two-tiered system.
The comprehensive waiver will be designed for those individuals with the greatest needs. It takes a lot more money to serve those individuals, but then the vast majority of the people will have beyond what's known as a support waiver, where it will be a capped dollar amount of which they can use that money to purchase the different services that they would like.
The idea is that the department would review each client, put them in the proper category, and then determine the amount they actually need.
We do not want to see people who have been identified for needing critical life, health, and safety services lose those services and be put at peril.
That's Jeannie Thobro of Wyoming Protection and Advocacy System, Inc., an organization that looks out for the rights of people with disabilities. PNA, as it is called, has forced the state to reform how it treated those with disabilities in the past. While she doesn't oppose looking at the system, Thobro notes that the department has been directed to make cuts, and that sends up a red flag.
We are seeing the potential of people who really do need services and have fairly gotten services being cut away from those services. And far more people are not getting needed services because of arbitrary limits being set.
The 24-year-old daughter of Linda Treese has been receiving services since 1991. The daughter lives at home, but Treese says her disability requires around-the-clock care.
It provides her with therapy services, time for my husband and I just to take the break. It provides a weekend a month without our daughter, some equipment that we needed over the years, and 24 years of wonderful, productive support.
But Treese doesn't like the change.
There are many people who are waiting so long to have some support. Unfortunately, what they're doing is they're taking away from those who are on and giving it to those who are not on, which is very scary. Very unsafe.
Other parents share this concern, and some claim their children have already had money taken away. Many of those providing services to people with disabilities are also concerned about the cuts. This is ARC Regional Services. It is the oldest service provider to those with developmental and intellectual disabilities in the state. President and CEO Shirley Pratt says reviewing the system is well-intentioned, but these cuts are not going to be enough to get many people off the waiting list.
You can't add the number of people that they're talking about adding without adding more money.
Pratt is also worried that the state and the legislature are missing the fact that some people in the program are already underfunded. And Pratt has another concern. That's that unqualified people may make decisions on the type of care someone needs.
I know that the people at the state, their intent is good, but I think if you've got bureaucrats making decisions about people's lives when they haven't been here, they're not involved, they're not part of that on a daily basis, I think you're going to run into trouble.
Department of Health Director Forslund says thanks to public comment, they have decided to be more deliberate with possible cuts. And when they decide to reduce funding, they will do it over time. But Forslund stresses that the law says they have to cut.
So the question is how do you change it and protect the people that are already in it and not disrupt their lives in a major, major way?
Jeannie Thobro of Protection and Advocacy wants the state to make sensible reductions and then realize that more money is needed. As an aside, Governor Matt Mead gave a speech the other day where he said if cuts don't have the desired result, then the legislature should put more money into the system. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Bob Beck.
Roughly a quarter of Teton County residents are living without health insurance. It's the worst rate of health coverage in the state. Beginning in October, those uninsured residents will have a new opportunity to get health insurance through a federally operated exchange or marketplace. Rebecca Huntington has more.
Dana Gadd is a massage therapist. She's putting towels in a warmer to get ready for her next client.
We sell feel good here, so I have to make sure all the products are nice and everybody's going to enjoy their experience.
Gat's self-employed and runs a massage business catering to Jackson's working class.
Spas are getting a little too gourmet for themselves, and I just kind of wanted to have fun and appeal more to the locals, us working schmucks, I like to say.
Her shop sits along a busy highway, leading north out of Jackson, in a weathered one-story strip mall. Even when she worked for fancy high-end spas, she says they didn't offer health benefits. Working as a massage therapist is much like other seasonal jobs in Jackson. People who cut lawns, clean houses, and wait tables are often on their own to buy health insurance. And Gat did that, for a while.
I think they start out really reasonable with the insurance program that I was with here.
But the rates didn't stay that way.
The rates just kept going up and up, and I think I had to stop at maybe around $530.
That's per month. So Gat dropped her private insurance in 2005. A single mom, she received Medicaid insurance available to low-income individuals for a few years. Her 7-year-old son still receives Medicaid, but Gat herself no longer qualifies.
She should be able to find something on the exchange and should get a subsidy on the exchange, depending upon her income.
That's Lou Hoheiser, CEO of St. John's Hospital in Jackson. He says that beginning October 1st, Gat will be able to go online to see what health plans and subsidies she's eligible for. The exchange will offer tax subsidies to middle-income individuals under age 65 who aren't eligible for insurance through their job, Medicaid, or Medicare.
The subsidies are really quite strong, but the hook is that there still will be a large deductible.
He says the exchange will offer 4 different kinds of plans, which look promising.
Around the country, despite the predictions of a lot of people that these plans were not going to be affordable, it's looking like they are coming in at an affordable rate.
That's good news for Gat, who says she'd like to buy health insurance for herself and her son instead of going without or depending on Medicaid. But she's still not sure how the exchange will work.
I need sort of a clear outline. I need somebody to say, well, this is what you pay for, and this is what you get.
Once the online exchange goes live next month, she'll be able to see specific plans and prices, and to calculate what subsidies she might qualify for. Under the new health reform law, by January 1st, GAT will have to buy some kind of insurance, or pay a penalty.
If they're going to force us to get health insurance, it has to be affordable. Don't tell me I have to pay, you know, two car payments or an additional mortgage.
GAT says she'll give the exchange a try, but she's not counting on it. In fact, she's already taken classes at a community college in order to apply for nursing school. She says she likes taking care of people. And nursing is a profession that hopefully comes with health care benefits. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Rebecca Huntington in Jackson.
When we come back, we'll hear about a major art collection in Cody that's at risk of being sold. This is Open Spaces. Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. The fate of a major art collection hangs in the balance as the estate of renowned Cody artist Harry Jackson looks for a benefactor. And unless a donor steps forward, Jackson's life work will be piecemealed to pay the bills, Wyoming Public Radio's Micah Schweitzer reports.
The late Harry Jackson is best known for his Western art, like the sculpture of a hard-riding John Wayne that graced the cover of Time magazine in 1969. He was born in Chicago, but Harry Jackson called Wyoming his spiritual birthplace. In 1938, when he was 14, he started working at the Pitchfork Ranch outside of Meteetse. That's where he learned cowboy songs later released on Smithsonian Folkways Records.
Well, come on, you cowboys, I'll sing you a song. Stay back from the wagon, stay where you belong. You think you're right handy with gunning with a rope, but I notice you're bashful when handling the soap. When rolling.
But that's just one side of Harry Jackson, as Cody painter John Jarizzo discovered during a six-month residency at the sprawling warehouse-like Harry Jackson Studios.
We thought of him as somebody who created these beautiful bronze sculptures that, you know, we're at the level of Frederick Remington, but then when you walk into that space, you're confronted with the full spectrum of who Harry Jackson was as an artist.
There's the Harry Jackson who was at the center of New York's abstract expressionist scene, painting alongside Jackson Pollock. There's the World War II Marine veteran and combat sketch artist. He was a Hollywood radio actor. He sang at Carnegie Hall with Bob Dylan and Joan Baez. Now, a new biography is capturing Jackson's colorful life.
I'm Henry Adams, and I'm professor of American art at Case Western Reserve University in Cleveland.
Adams did research for his book at what he calls the Jackson Trove in Cody.
I find that I'm sort of overwhelmed by the extent of the material. It's an amazing record of a life that is really quite unusual, if not unique, to have all that stuff together in one place.
The place, a tan, industrial-looking building ringed by a chain-link fence, hardly looks like a museum. The sign out front says, by appointment only, and it certainly is worth an appointment. There are 5,000 drawings, 400 paintings, and hundreds of sculptures, essentially Harry Jackson's entire output, much of it on display in a gallery setting. Harry Jackson's oldest son, Matt Jackson, oversees the estate.
We have a complete array of his life's work. So these are childhood drawings that his mother kept.
plus more than 100 journals dating from 1945 to the artist's death in 2011, his annotated library, letters, and other archival materials. But now it's in jeopardy. To keep this sometimes overwhelming collection together, Matt Jackson needs to raise about $5 million to pay the bills, care for the collection, and lay the foundation for a working institution. And while there are some hopeful signs, he says there are no firm financial commitments yet.
It's definitely a money question. And time is running out, so.
And by time is running out, Jackson means the estate will start selling pieces in October to stay afloat. And while many works have financial value, Jackson says they're intrinsically more valuable in the context of the whole collection.
You know, we'll see where it goes. There's a lot of excitement. There's just, a little bit of a funding gap.
I think situations like this are very complicated.
Susan Moldenhauer heads the University of Wyoming Art Museum.
There's the safety of the work. There's the protection of the work. There's, how do you sustain a collection? How do you have it support itself as a collection? And I think those are all questions that Matt is really struggling with right now.
Moldenhauer was part of a group of Wyoming cultural and arts organizations that met at the Harry Jackson Studios in August. The group drafted a statement affirming the value of the estate as a whole. Painter John Jarizzo was also there. Here's how he sums up the collection.
It redefines Wyoming and its art status culturally in the country and maybe globally. The fact that it is still together and that there's a chance of it now dispersing seems like a travesty.
Meanwhile, Matt Jackson has traveling exhibits planned, but if he's forced to start selling pieces, portions of the collection won't be making a return trip to Cody. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Micah Schweitzer.
Former lawyer-turned-fly fishing guide David Riley Birch has written a book dealing with both of his passions. Jake Trent is the main character in the book called Death Canyon. Trent is a former criminal lawyer-turned-fly fishing guide who runs a bed and breakfast in Jackson, Wyoming. A late-season avalanche kills a skier. A French couple may have suffered a bear attack, and Jake himself finds the body of a tourist in fishing gear. The mysterious death sets the town on edge, and some think Jake may be involved. Jake finds a park ranger to help him investigate the deaths and determine who is trying to frame him, and it leads to some scary discoveries. Author David Riley Birch joins us and says his personal life led to this book.
You know, when I moved here, my wife hadn't moved out yet. I was kind of living alone just with the dogs, and I had some free time, and obviously the landscape was very inspiring. Fly fishing was very inspiring to me, and so kind of took that free time and started jotting some things down, and as it gained momentum, you know, I started forming it into a book, and when that was finished, I figured I should show it to somebody.
Now, is Jake Trent you?
I wish. Jake Trent is, you know, what I would like to be like if I was a, you know, better, physically stronger, smarter, nicer person. All those things, you know, wrapped up into one is what Jake Trent is.
Well, since we're talking about the book Death Canyon, and it is a Jake Trent novel, why don't we have you explain to the listeners a little bit about Jake Trent?
So Jake Trent is a retired criminal prosecutor. He has moved to Jackson basically for the same reasons I did. You know, that is to say, kind of get away from it all, find some peace, do the things that he cares about rather than the things that he's kind of, you know, ended up doing after life kind of got to him. He's now kind of working part-time as a fishing guide here in Jackson. He does have some ties, you know, to his old job as a prosecutor, some sort of quasi-special agent-type connections that will come back and haunt him and, you know, end up providing the storylines for the series.
Now, one of the things that happened, he gets there, there's some mysterious deaths, some interesting things happening, and since I guess he's the new guy in town, they think maybe he's behind some of this. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, it's the new guy thing, you know, and I think also the town, maybe especially the guys in the town, the men, have this somewhat resentful feeling towards him. Thinking that maybe he thinks he's a big shot, when in fact that's probably not quite in his personality. And also just the circumstances under which he finds this first body are suspicious. So that leads to, you know, him feeling somewhat framed and the police kind of believing that he's involved.
And then he decides he better prove that he's not and launches his own investigation.
Correct. That and, you know, this kind of curiosity that he still has that's kind of, you know, innate to him of wanting to, you know, I guess solve crimes, figure things out. And so those two in combination lead to him getting involved.
Yeah, I don't know what happened in Jackson when you first moved there, but boy, you've got everything going on. You've got avalanches, you've got bear attacks, you've got all kinds of different things. What, I guess, influenced you to write about those things and work those into the book?
Well, I think they're, you know, fairly unique to here, you know, here being Jackson. And I think for me, coming from the East Coast, they're things that I wasn't familiar with. So they were interesting, kind of intriguing, you know. And it being sort of an eco-thriller, I wanted to have some, you know, some connection between the natural world and then whatever the, you know, crimes were or whatever, you know, kind of the first plot line is, which is the murders. I wanted to connect those two.
Were you really trying to make this more of a Western book?
I was, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, since kind of the landscape and just being here inspired me so much, it was going to naturally go that way. But no, I intentionally wanted it to be, you know, events, plot lines, characters, and stuff that are probably unique to kind of this Western style of life.
We're visiting with the author David Birch. He has written a book, Death Canyon, a Jake Trent novel. It leads me to believe that you want to write more about Jake.
Oh, yeah. We've got a year from now, I think, down the line, we've got a sequel coming up. I'm about, I would say, 60% done with it. I hope to, you know, do a book a year for as long as I can.
You're getting a lot of good reviews on this. I mean, that's got to be heartening.
It is, yeah. You know, you always, being an author, I think any type of artist, you kind of always search for the bad points of any good review, so you have to be careful and not let yourself do that. But yeah, no, it feels great to read that people are enjoying it.
Obviously, we just gave it away, but Jake isn't going to get convicted.
No. I think he could have guessed that.
Again, we do wish you well with this, and welcome to Wyoming.
All righty, thanks so much.
The book Death Canyon, the first novel by author David Riley Birch, is currently on sale, and as he mentioned, more will be on the way.
When we come back, we'll hear what Wyoming's congressional delegation thinks about President Obama's stance on Syria, and we'll look at a growing trend of people buying ranches as investments. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. President Obama's call to postpone a vote on a military strike in Syria is being lauded by Wyoming's lawmakers. Matt Laszlo reports from Washington that while the administration is leaving a military option on the table as it pursues diplomacy, officials cannot expect much support from the Wyoming delegation.
Only a handful of lawmakers in the U.S. Senate have gone on record over authorizing military force in Syria. One of them is Wyoming Republican John Barrasso.
Mr. Barrasso?
Before he cast that vote opposing a military strike, Barrasso questioned the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Martin Dempsey, about the possible fallout of U.S. military action.
If we do a limited strike as proposed, and still Assad goes back and uses chemical weapons on his people, then that engenders an entire new set of hearings. And how does this end? Where are we a month from now?
We're preparing several target sets, the first of which would set the conditions for follow-on assessments, and the others would be used if necessary, and we haven't gotten to that point yet. What we do know is that we can degrade and disrupt his capabilities.
As with many Republicans, those answers failed to convince Barrasso. That's partly because of what he's hearing from people across Wyoming.
All believe what is happening in Syria is awful, despicable. Do have concerns about the administration and what the plan really is, what a strategy really is. They want to know what the core national security interests of the United States are that are at stake in Syria? What is our ultimate goal of proposed military strikes, and what happens if the strikes are not effective?
Wyoming's senior Republican Senator Mike Enzi wasn't available for an interview, but he issued a statement opposing the administration's call for a military strike. It reads in part that President Obama painted himself into a corner with his red line comments, and now he's trying to transfer ownership to Congress. Enzi's Republican primary challenger, Liz Cheney, also opposes a military strike. At a town hall meeting, she accused the president of having an amateurish approach to national security and foreign policy, according to the Jackson Hole News and Guide. Back here in Washington, the president isn't finding any allies in the Wyoming congressional delegation.
I opposed U.S. involvement in the Syria civil war.
That's Republican Congresswoman Cynthia Lummis. She says some conflicts in the Middle East don't need U.S. involvement.
Having the U.S. interject itself into an Arab against Arab civil war, I believe, could only bring a situation to Syria where Arabs are killed and the U.S. is blamed. So the Arab world needs to sort these out in the Arab world.
But the president and his allies in Congress argue the United States can't stand by as a dictator gasses his own people, in part because it could embolden other nations. Here's New York Congressman Steve Israel, who heads the campaign arm of House Democrats.
And should our response be to Bashar al-Assad and Iran and North Korea, no worries. No, our response should be you should worry. You should worry that when you contemplate the use of chemical weapons or use chemical weapons, that there will be an international response.
While Senator Barrasso opposed military authorization in the Foreign Relations Committee, Virginia Democrat Tim Kaine supported it. As the bell rings at the Capitol, alerting lawmakers of a vote, Kaine explains why he believes his committee vote helps spur international negotiations.
This is important. And look, I think the president's leadership on this is already having an effect. I don't think the Russian, we got to get more details about this Russian proposal. There is no way that would have happened if the president hadn't brought us back to discuss this matter. It's already having an effect. So let's play it out.
Lummis concedes that Kaine may have a point, but that's not changing her belief that the president took some missteps.
They might be right. But I wish the president had been more assertive, more clear. I felt that he waffled. I felt that not coming to the American people initially and making the case was a mistake.
Both sides of the debate over military action are hoping Secretary of State John Kerry can use diplomacy with Russian officials to put Syria's chemical weapons under international control. Lummis says it could be a breakthrough.
I'm actually very pleased now that we're going to pursue some diplomatic channels through which we might be able to acquire the chemical weapons that Syria has. We meaning countries other than Syria.
For now, many lawmakers on Capitol Hill are breathing a sigh of relief as the spotlight has been taken off them and turned on to the UN Security Council. But the president may come knocking on lawmakers' doors again in the near future. If he does, he shouldn't expect much help from the Wyoming congressional delegation. From Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
Real estate brokers across Wyoming and the West have been seeing more and more people buying ranches for investment purposes. In many cases, that's changing the way the ranches function and affecting communities around them. Wyoming Public Radio's Willow Belden reports.
Art Siegel is a retired chemical engineer from Chicago. Well, sort of retired. He's no longer a chemical engineer, but now he and his wife own and operate a ranch in southeast Wyoming.
I've always had a love of the West. And when I retired in 2005, we found this ranch after searching near and far. And so that's kind of how we settled here.
The ranch is nestled at the foot of the Snowy Range. Grassy fields give way to sagebrush-covered slopes and aspen groves. Siegel runs yearlings on the ranch, and he says he loves the work and the lifestyle. Several of his children, and now grandchildren, live on the ranch too.
We hope that it will stay in the family for many generations to come, and the family will, in one way or another, enjoy it as we do.
Siegel is one of many people from out of state who have made their money elsewhere and are now buying ranch real estate in Wyoming. But he's a little different than most. B. Elfland is a broker with Fay Ranches, a real estate firm that sells ranch property in Wyoming and neighboring states. Elfland says unlike Siegel, most buyers don't actually live on the ranches or do the work themselves.
Typically, they are a seasonal destination, and they typically employ people as ranch managers and, you know, a variety of other levels of help.
Elfland says they buy the ranches because they want a safe place to park some of their money. And he says a ranch is a valuable addition to almost any investment portfolio.
It would be hard for anyone to convince me that there's a better investment out there than land.
That's because real estate is more stable than, say, the stock market.
But they don't look at it necessarily as a property that's going to give them a return on investment or immediate return on investment.
That's James Reinhardt, the Laramie real estate agent who handled the sale of Art Siegel's ranch. He says buying a ranch is not a way to get rich quick. Many of his clients, like Siegel, buy these ranches for the lifestyle they offer, for the hunting and fishing opportunities, for a chance to leave the city behind and own a piece of wide open space. But whatever the motivation of the buyers, Reinhardt says the change in land ownership can affect local communities.
These ranches, they're not the family ranches anymore. It changes the whole dynamic of the local ranchers.
Reinhardt says the changes can bring economic benefits to a community, but there are also costs. For example, in many cases, there are no kids on the ranches anymore.
Some of the schools will not have as good of enrollment, so you're going to see some of the schools closing. You're going to see situations where you don't have the family dynamics on each one of the ranches. Now, some of the owners will hire some families, but it's been hard to do, and it's hard to see them move forward with that.
And there's a bigger problem. Brett Moline with the Wyoming Farm Bureau Federation says wealthy buyers are driving up land prices, so much so that ranchers can't afford to buy ranch land anymore.
It's harder for locals to be able to purchase land to either start an operation or to expand their current operation. It's selling for prices that are much higher than what the agricultural enterprises will support.
Moline says that has not led to a major decrease in the productivity of Wyoming's ranches, but it does make it very tough for aspiring ranchers to get a foot in the door. They can find jobs as ranch hands, but they can't start their own operation. Chris Bastian is a professor of agricultural and applied economics at the University of Wyoming. He says agricultural land prices have been rising for decades, and part of the reason is because land values are no longer based solely on how productive the land is. Instead, they're also based on things like pretty views and good fishing opportunities.
We're seeing more people with non-agricultural interests purchasing agricultural properties, and they're willing to pay for these amenities beyond agricultural productivity.
And Bastian says as the rich get richer and more people own second homes, the trend is likely to grow. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Willow Belden.
As we just heard, many Wyoming ranches are being purchased by out-of-state residents. Many of these ranches are up for sale in the first place because older ranchers don't have their heirs who want or know how to run a ranch full-time. Or the kids can't agree on what to do with a family ranch after their parents pass away. So, ranching advocacy groups are trying to come up with ways to help manage non-traditional succession plans. Jim Magagna of the Wyoming Stock Growers Association tells Wyoming Public Radio's Rebecca Martinez that it is important to find ways to help farmers get their money's worth for their land while keeping it in production.
If you look at projected world demand for food supplies, if you look at the demand in Wyoming today for good, healthy habitats for wildlife and open space, ag production complements and helps to meet all of those demands. So it's in our interest to keep properties in production agriculture.
So what is the Stock Growers Association doing to help young people and ranchers basically have a more symbiotic relationship as ranchers are transitioning out of operation and young people are looking to take that up?
I would mention probably three things in particular. 2 years ago, we started an educational program we called MAP, Making a Plan Workshops, that are designed to bring two generations of a family together, really, and help them to initiate those sometimes very difficult conversations about ranchland succession. And, you know, I have heard young ranchers come to me and say, you know, I'm 45 years old and I've been working on the family ranch since I got out of college. but dad still makes all the decisions. So how do we make those two generations understand that a transition should be a gradual process? It shouldn't be something that awaits the death of the older generation, and then the younger one suddenly is faced with decisions that he's never had to deal with before. So part of it is planning, and we've done a number of things to focus on planning. The second thing we've done is directed more toward the issue of ranch succession where there isn't a family member. And we, along with the Wyoming Department of Agriculture, initiated a couple years ago what we've termed the WAGON program, Wyoming Ag Ownership Network, to find opportunities to partner up young people with a strong interest and, in some cases, some considerable experience in ranching or farming with mentors. And it can take several directions. In some cases, it can be a very experienced young individual or couple with a rancher who is really looking for someone that can take over their ranch. And assuming that relationship evolves over a period of time, we'll take some steps to help make sure that it becomes viable over time for that young couple or individual to end up owning that ranch. And then the third component is more of just an internship program, which we established just this summer. We were able to put five young people who are all still in college out on three-month internships with ranches across the state. But the expectation of that rancher is that they involve these people in every aspect of the ranching operation. So they're working, but they're not just a worker out there. They're learning about the various aspects of being successful ranchers. And it's a long-term process. I can't point to any immediate dramatic results that come from it, but we're very confident that over time it will become an important tool in moving people forward. There's one other one that I believe has tremendous potential. We have a Wyoming Stock Growers Land Trust, and the Land Trust is primarily focused on holding conservation easements on ranching properties. And those easements can be a tool because by selling an easement, because they are a way for an existing ranch to derive a significant portion of the value of their land, typically it might be around 40%, in terms of a cash payment, that devalues the land, the remaining value in the land for agricultural production, and makes it more affordable to either family succession or to a young person that's coming in and attempting to acquire that ranch.
Now, I'm curious, how receptive have existing ranchers been to these efforts, to the mentorship program and to participating in these easements?
I wouldn't want to say that ranchers are running to grab a hold of any of these programs, but I think they're open-minded. And one of the things that is certainly very helpful, most longtime family ranchers that run two, three, four, and even more generations in Wyoming, they want to see not only the land kept in open space, but they want to see that ranching operation continue, albeit recognizing that changes will take place. So I think that is a huge driver, causing them to be more willing to look at some of the options that might be out there to help assure that their generation of work and that of their parents and grandparents continues into the next generation.
Now, ranchers sort of have their reservations about some of these programs, but you say that they're open-minded. They're going to continue to age. So what do you see happening as far as ranchland succession in the next decade or two?
I'm generally optimistic. I think that the opportunity to see succession moving into the next generation is greater today than I've known it, certainly in the last 30 years, in part because the economics are improved, at least at the moment, and the trends looking ahead, I think it's going to generally be a positive economic outlook for people to getting into farming and ranching. I think that the growing interest of young people for doing this, partly as a way of life, partly because maybe all the other opportunities aren't as glamorous as they appeared to be a few years back. The relatively weak economy that we've experienced the last few years, we've kind of escaped that. Perhaps that helps. Historically, we looked at ranching and farming as just meeting a demand for food and fiber. Today, it has the potential certainly to meet that demand, and we know globally that that demand is going to do nothing but grow. But it also has the opportunity to meet the demand with some economic return for providing so many other amenities that people want, of open space, of hunting and fishing opportunities, providing habitat for endangered species and receiving some economic return for that. There are more options on the table today, which all contribute, I think, toward that more positive outlook.
Jim Magagna, thanks so much for talking with me.
And thank you.
Jim Magagna is with the Wyoming Stock Growers Association.
When we come back, can gardening improve your health? This is Open Spaces.
Welcome to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Willow Belden. With help from a $5 million USDA grant, the University of Wyoming and two local groups are conducting a study of the health benefits of gardening. They found 14 volunteers with significant medical issues to start growing food in their own backyards. The goal is to see if gardening improves their health. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards reports.
Gail Woodsum runs a group called Feeding Laramie Valley, which collects fresh fruits and vegetable donations and distributes the produce to soup kitchens and other organizations. Woodsum can often be found working on her vegetable plot in the Labonte Community Garden, weeding or picking beets, broccoli, and yellow squash. This morning, she's doing some hoeing, but she doesn't just tend her own garden. She's working to build gardens for people with serious health problems. It's part of a research project.
We give people gardens. We get them started. We put them in. We work with the people who have them and then measure whether or not there's a health effect on them. So all the people involved have some sort of health challenge.
Challenges that range from diabetes to arthritis. The participants for the study came from all socioeconomic and age groups. At the start, they recorded a lot of data about their medical problems. At the end of the gardening season, they'll go through the same retinue of tests again to see if they're healthier. In the sunny side yard of his duplex apartment in Laramie, Jason Nichols waters his zucchini plants. These days, he and his mother, Tara Nichols, spend most of their mornings in the garden. They volunteered to participate in the garden study after hearing about it through Jason's therapist. Both of them have lots of medical challenges.
Well, I myself have a lot of, chronic conditions, nothing acute. Osteoarthritis, which has gotten real bad up here, heart condition, diabetes, and asthma. Not to say the least of which is anxiety disorder and depression.
Since they started participating in the study, they've been eating lots of fresh vegetables. And Tara Nichols says she's getting more exercise because she's climbing the stairs 3 and 4 times a day to be outside tending her garden or just admiring it. She says it seems to be helping.
But I managed to keep off 4 pounds, but my blood sugar has stabilized for the first time in a long, long time. So that's what it's done for me.
Tara says she's curious to find out objectively if she really is healthier. The project is the brainchild of Dr. Christine Porter, an assistant professor of public health at UW. Porter says it's important to give people control over their health, and gardening is an excellent way to do that. She says there are lots of observational studies of gardening's effect on health, but this is the only study collecting scientific data that she knows of.
So our goal here ultimately is to do a randomized controlled trial so that you can be sure that the benefits that are being attributed to gardens are true. And if we can prove those benefits, which include not only access to food, increased fruits and vegetable consumption, but increased activity, lowered stress, increased social networks, even with home gardens, interestingly.
The study will track a wide array of health measures, including blood pressure, blood glucose, and even cortisol in the saliva as an indication of stress levels. They are doing the study in 2 places, Laramie and the Wind River Indian Reservation. On the reservation, diabetes is so prevalent that the life expectancy is only 59. Jim Sutter with Blue Mountain Associates, the Wind River Reservation group partnering on the study, says he's already seeing results, at least anecdotally.
Because I've seen the gardeners that have been already, utilizing the produce from their gardens, and they're happier and just look healthier than when we started this.
Sutter says many participants have been building more garden beds on their own and asking if they can have larger gardens next year. In fact, Sutter says they've gone one step further and are preserving and canning as well. The results of the study will be analyzed and released after the growing season is wrapped up in October. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Melody Edwards.
David Romvet teaches in the Masters of Fine Arts program for writers at the University of Wyoming and served as the state's poet laureate from 2003 to 2011. Today, we'll hear three of his poems about his daughter.
Sunday morning early. My daughter and I paddle red kayaks across the lake. Pulling hard, we slip through the water. Far from either shore, my daughter is a young woman, and suddenly everything is a metaphor for how short a time we are granted. The red boats on the blue-black water, the russet and gold of late summer's grasses, the empty sky. We stop and listen to the stillness. I say, "It's Sunday, and here we are in the Church of the Out of Doors." Then wish I'd kept quiet. That's the trick in life, learning to leave well enough alone. Our boats drift to where the churring of grasshoppers reaches us from the rocky hills, a clap of thunder. I want to say something truer than "I love you." I want my daughter to know that through her, I live a life that was closed to me. I paddle up, lean out, and touch her hand. I start to speak, then stop. Surprise breakfast. One winter morning, I get up early to clean the ash from the grate and find my daughter, 8, in the kitchen, thumping around pretending she has a peg leg, while also breaking eggs into a bowl, separating yolks and white, mixing oil and milk. Her hands are smooth, not from lack of labor, but youth. She's making pancakes for me, a surprise I have accidentally ruined. "You never get up early," she says, measuring the baking powder, beating the egg whites. It's true. When I wake, I roll to the side and pull the covers over my head. "It was too cold to sleep," I say. "I thought I'd get the kitchen warm." Aside from the scraping of the small flat shovel on the iron grate and the wooden spoon turning in the bowl, the room is quiet. I lift the gray ash and lay it carefully into a bucket to take outside. "How'd you lose your leg?" I ask. "At sea. I fell overboard in a storm and a shark attacked me, but I'm fine." She spins, a little batter flying from the spoon. I can hear the popping of the oil in the pan. "Are you ready?" she asks, thumping to the stove. Fork in hand, I sit down, hoping that, yes, I am ready, or nearly so. Or one day will be. Late winter ski trip. Rubbing my hands to keep warm, I sit in the trees and watch the snow hut melt, the rain falling like girders from the tops of buildings. I stare into the mist, trying to see down the mountain to the houses below, smoke rising from the chimneys. My daughter and I eat breakfast, raisins and nuts in tin cups of yogurt. She paces now and again looking up at the dark clouds. Under her coat, her skin is smooth with only buds where there will be breasts. The rain turns to hail, teeth cracked from the mouth of the sky. Finished eating and anxious to set off, we nearly pour the sticky red clister wax onto our skis. Now the hail softens, becoming snow, the disembodied wings of angels falling. There's no point in waiting any longer. No point in staying forever in the trees. I'm David Romvet.
That's our program for this week. If you want to hear it again, you can find it online at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
You can also send us ideas for future programs on that site and sign up for our podcast. Anna Rader is our web editor. For those of you on Facebook, we invite you to become a fan of Wyoming Public Radio News by clicking on the like button. And for news updates and less important information, you can follow all of us on Twitter. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.